Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Clay Gordon, and you're listening to Straight from the Source, streaming to you on heritageradionetwork.org. You can always find the show archived on heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes. In the nearly 20 years that I've been following the chocolate industry, literally from tree to mouth, I visited cacao farms throughout the Americas and spent time with farmers, cacao merchants, and some of the world's finest chocolate makers. Growing cacao is very hard work, and it's hard not to notice that farmers are often not paid fairly for the work that they do. Straight from the Source is inspired by those experiences with the mission of exploring issues in fair and ethical sourcing in cacao, chocolate, coffee, and other foods with participants involved in every link of the supply chain, from growers to producers to chefs, certification bodies, and organizations interested in promoting the concept of good food. But today we're going to be talking about chocolate, and specifically how chocolate gets made. What are the processes? What is the route by which chocolate is made from cocoa beans that are grown in the tropics? The first thing to understand about chocolate is that the difference between a good chocolate and a great chocolate is paying attention to every step of the process, every step of the way, and doing what is necessary and what is in the best interests of the chocolate. It's about not making compromises, and it's about taking the time to do it right. And taking the time to do it right is expensive, as it turns out, as you might imagine. Now, chocolate making is divided into two different parts. Some of it happens on the farm in a cocoa-growing country, and some of it starts in the factory. And in the first segment today, we're going to be focusing on the stuff that happens on the farm. And after we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about what happens in the factory. So on the farm, there are going to be three primary processes that happen. The harvesting of the cocoa when it's ripe, the fermentation of the cocoa beans, and the drying of the cocoa beans. All of these things contribute to the quality of the cocoa beans as the primary ingredient that the chocolate is going to be made out of. We're not going to be discussing issues today about terroir, what kinds of growing conditions and the varieties of beans that are used. That's going to be for a future episode on how chocolate gets its taste. Today, we're just going to be focusing on how chocolate gets made. So harvesting starts with a farmer going out into his orchard, going out into his farm, and pulling the ripe cocoa pods off the tree. Now, cocoa pods don't, if the cocoa pod falls on the ground, it's overripe and it's not good, so you can't scavenge pods off the ground. But the farmer looks around his orchard, and at any time over the course of the year, there are always some pods that are ripe, although there are two major harvesting seasons, a primary and secondary season, roughly 6 months apart from each other. The farmer goes in, looks at his trees, pulls the ripe ones that are down, being very, very careful not to damage the cushion out of which the pod grows. Anytime a cushion is damaged, no cocoa pod will grow there in the future. The pods are carefully split open. You want to, all the pods are either split open using a mallet, or they're hit against the ground or some sharp object, or they're opened with a machete. If you are not careful, or if the farmer is not careful about how the pod is opened and seeds inside are damaged, those damaged seeds can be like a bad apple in a barrel. It can infect and reduce the quality of the cocoa in the future steps of the process. Ideally, the farmer or whoever is harvesting looks at all of the seeds that come out of the pod which are covered in this beautiful mucilaginous pulp that's really, really tasty and yummy. And is if you haven't had the opportunity to go to Origin and suck the cocoa pulp off a cocoa seed or a fresh cocoa pod, it's something I certainly encourage everyone to do. The farmers get paid by weight, and so they want to make sure that every seed that they harvest is in the final pile that they're selling. But obviously, if they've taken the machete and sliced a bean, as far as I, as a chocolate maker, am concerned, I'd like the farmer to throw that bean away or not include it in the steps. Or if the bean is diseased, there are a lot of diseases that affect the cocoa pod, and I want to make sure that the farmer is culling those badly damaged or damaged in however slightly seeds before they go into the next step of the process, which is fermentation. So after the farmer has collected enough seeds to make up a fermentation pile, or if they're working in a cooperative with a number of other farmers, the group of farmers has gotten enough beans together in order to be able to ferment them, they take them usually to a central place where there are the facilities to do the fermentation. Fermentation for cocoa is absolutely necessary for the development of the flavors that we admire most in chocolate. It's not absolutely necessary to ferment cocoa. Many people believe it's absolutely necessary to ferment cocoa in order to develop any sort of chocolate flavor. It turns out that fermentation is required for developing a whole range of flavors, but not the basic chocolate flavor. So if you ferment and then dry and roast, and then make chocolate from those beans, you do get a plain, basic, not very nuanced, sometimes very rough chocolate flavor. But it's through fermentation that we develop a whole range of chemicals, proteins, amino acids, sugars, complex carbohydrates, things that when the cocoa bean is roasted, that they make themselves available to the roasting process through what are called the Maillard reactions, which we know from baking bread and caramelizing sugar, that we can develop all these fabulous flavors in the fermentation. Now, fermentation is a time-consuming step. So depending upon where you are in the world and what varieties of cocoa you're fermenting, the fermentation process could take anywhere between 3 and 7 days. So it can't take longer. On the island of Grenada, the government is responsible. They buy all the beans and do all the fermentation, and they put them together in very huge boxes, probably 6 tons of cocoa beans in each box. And in Grenada, the fermentation takes 8 days, in part because of the huge mass of beans. And it's quite a sight, actually, to see a worker open up the side of one of these 6-ton boxes and with a shovel, one shovel at a time, move 6 tons of cocoa beans from one box to another in order to be able to inject air into the mix. Traditionally, if I'm a small farmer somewhere, I will just clear a little bit of the forest floor, put down some banana leaves, put my pile of cocoa beans on top of the banana leaves, put some more banana leaves on top of that, weigh it down with a rock, and hope that there is enough mass there so that I'll generate enough heat in the fermentation process. The fermentation happens because there are wild yeasts and bacteria on the outside of the pods and on the leaves, and those react with the sugars that are in the pulp. Now, people mistakenly believe that the cocoa beans are ferment, and the beans themselves don't ferment. It is the pulp that is on the outside of the beans that ferments. Right? And there's a two-stage process. The first part of the fermentation, yeasts convert the sugars into alcohol. After a period of time, 2 days, 3 days, however long it is, again, depending upon where in the world the fermentation is happening, the pile is opened and air is incorporated into the pile. And at this point, bacteria take over, primarily a class of bacteria known as Acetobacter. And this Acetobacter converts the alcohol into acetic acid. This whole fermentation process generates a fair amount of heat, gets up to about 125 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe a little higher sometimes, depending upon the size of the pile, at which time the seed is killed The cacao seed is killed. It's no longer viable. The germ no longer will sprout. And a complex series of chemical reactions happens inside of the seed itself. And the seed is fissured and fractured, and it becomes less of a solid mass and becomes something that is friable when the cacao bean gets dried. So after fermentation, the next step is drying the cocoa bean. And drying the cocoa bean is, again, a very, very important step. If you do it too quickly, it turns out that there is a lot of acidity, excess acidity, which remains in the center of the bean because it doesn't get evaporated out. If you do it too slowly, the bean can mold and mildew. And so it's necessary to be able to dry the beans in a controlled fashion to get the moisture down to about 6 to 7%, which is where the beans are shippable. Too much moisture in the bean, and the bean will mold and mildew as it travels across the ocean. And if there's not enough moisture, the beans will experience a high degree of breakage as they get moved around from one part of the world to the other. A lot of the drying that gets done in the sun. It's a preferred method. It's an age-old method of doing it. If you're lucky, you have a concrete pad. That pad heats up quite nicely in the sun. You throw the beans out on the pad, and you turn them over the course of the day. In Grenada, they don't turn them using a shovel. They walk on the beans and spread them using their feet. The individual practices are different from one part of the world to another. In Ecuador, I've seen on a number of different occasions where the farmers put their cocoa beans out on the side of the road. Now, sometimes they put them directly on the road, which means the beans can absorb the flavor of asphalt. And depending upon the road, they can also absorb diesel fumes as the buses drive on the road. In places in Venezuela, I've seen them use side roads where there's not much traffic of any kind, as well as put the beans on top of tarps. And now putting them on tops of tarps also makes it easy in case it starts to rain or something like that. They can just roll up the tarp and carry the beans inside and keep the beans from getting wet. In some parts of the world, Indonesia, for example, parts of Africa, it never actually gets warm enough, and it's usually too humid in order to be able to dry the beans successfully. And so what they will do is they will create some sort of fire. So sometimes they'll use propane or butane and light a fire and warm up air and blow the air over the beans and dry them. And sometimes they will burn coconut shells, which is a common practice in little countries like Vanuatu and other places in the South Pacific. And sometimes they burn firewood. The use of firewood to dry cocoa beans is a huge issue in some parts of the world, particularly West Africa and in Cameroon, where I was just made aware of it, where it could take 3 tons of biomass, 3 tons of wood, to dry 1 ton of cocoa beans. Now, obviously, that's hugely has a huge impact on deforestation. It's very, very expensive, and the carbon offset is a huge problem. The other issue associated with that is that sometimes the smell of smoke gets in the beans. If you have a chocolate made from beans from Indonesia and it smells smoky, one of the reasons why is that the beans may have picked up the flavor or the aroma of wood smoke during the process of drying. Right. So after the beans are dried, the farmer submits them to a buyer. The buyer grades them. Every single country has a different grading mechanism. And this is one of the places where the buyer has an enormous amount of leverage. I mean, the farmer wants money. They want to sell their beans. The grader comes in and says, your beans are not of the quality you think they are. And instead of being able to offer you this amount of price, the market price today is $2,500 a ton. I'm going to take 10% off or 20% off because there are lots of defects in your beans. And the farmer goes, oh, but I need money today. I need money today. And eventually they'll say, well, okay, I'll sell you the beans at the price you pay, even though it's not the market price, because I need to go I need to go to the grocery store and feed my family tonight. So it's a very complex process of harvesting, fermentation, and drying that we've covered in brief. This is a subject that there are doctorates on in microbiology and other aspects. There's an enormous amount of research and development which goes on in fermentation cultures and processes and the best ways of drying and, you know, what the actual chemical processes are that go on during fermentation and drying. We don't have time to cover those today. I've given a brief overview in this segment. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about the process of making chocolate that happens in the factory. And you'll learn a little bit more on Straight from the Source on heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm sitting in the grass, cross-legged, with my leg bounced.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA. Since the inception of the Heritage Turkey Project, more than 10 of Frank Reese's partner farms have converted to Good Shepherd from a corporate system whose weak protocols on husbandry, welfare, and genetics necessitated the use of subtherapeutic antibiotics at all stages of production. When Frank Reese started in 2002, he hatched 900 eggs in his barn. This year, 20,000 eggs were hatched. This is an enormous victory for sustainable agriculture and biodiversity. For more information and to order your Heritage Turkey today, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Welcome back to Straight from the Source on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Clay Gordon, creator and moderator of thechocolatelife.com and author of the IACP finalist book, Discover Chocolate. And that's what we're doing today. We're talking about chocolate and how chocolate gets made, bean to bar. We spent the first half of the program, the first segment, talking about what happens on the farm, harvesting, fermentation, and drying, a quick overview of a very, very complex subject. Okay. And in this half of the program, we're going to be talking about what happens in the factory. Now, chocolate is one of those interesting gourmet foods. It's different from almost every other gourmet food in the world in that the primary raw material, which is cocoa beans, are grown thousands of miles from where the finished product is made. So if you think about cheese, the cows are right there next to where the cheese is made. If you think about wine, I mean, part of the terroir and the appellation is that, you know, the reason why it's champagne grapes, it's champagne grapes in the Champagne region. And in cocoa or in chocolate, there are actually very few internationally recognized companies that produce chocolate in country. So one of them is a company called El Rey from Venezuela. There's a company called El Sebo, which is down in Bolivia. There's a very interesting gentleman, Claudio Corallo, or Carallo, depending upon how you pronounce your Portuguese. I believe he prefers Corallo, who's on the islands of Sao Tome and Principe, that produce a world-class chocolate. There's a little bit done in Madagascar as well. But in general, when you think about where cocoa beans are grown, which are Bolivia, Ecuador, the tropics, Bali, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, around the world, there's very little world-class chocolate that gets made in these places comparatively. The cocoa beans get purchased and shipped primarily to North America and to Europe, where very large companies and some very small companies convert the beans into chocolate and sell it here. And then One of the ironies, of course, is that most of the growers of chocolate or cocoa beans in the world have actually never tasted chocolate. So they don't really have an idea, number one, of what their beans are used to make. And they really don't have an understanding of how small changes in their practices can change the quality. I mean, the better the job that they do in country, the higher the quality of the chocolate, the better the chocolate tastes. And farmers would be happy to do the work, of course, if they were paid properly for the work. I mean, chocolate, as we know it, is incredibly inexpensive. It is probably the most affordable luxury gourmet food that I can think of. And the price spread between the everyday chocolate that we buy and the most expensive chocolate that you can purchase is very narrow compared with many other gourmet foods. I mean, one of the ironies here is that the Queen of England, with all her billions, can't buy better chocolate than you can. You can walk into a store with a $20 bill and get some of the best chocolate in the world, although many people would be horrified at the thought that there was a chocolate bar that actually cost $20. Well, these same people have no problem spending $100 on a bottle of wine, or $200 or $300 on a bottle of wine, or a single malt scotch, or, you know, $70 a pound for a farmstead cheese. There is no difference. The more you know about chocolate, the more you know about how hard it is to make, just how unusual it is for there to be a fabulous chocolate. I mean, there are 1,000 ways to ruin a chocolate, from the beans on the tree to your mouth, for every way there is to make a really, really good chocolate. And a friend of mine, Art Pollard, who's the founder of one of the founders of Amano Chocolate out in Utah, says the problem with chocolate is that every step is the most important step. There are so many ways to mess it up, and in order to make a good one and make it consistently, it is really all about no compromises. You take all the time it takes. You know, you respect what it is that the beans are telling you, and you do what is necessary in order to make a fabulous chocolate. So once I get the beans in the factory, what does that mean? Well, the first thing to have to do is I have to clean the beans. The beans have traveled across the ocean for the most part, and because the farmers get paid by weight, it's not unusual to find nails and sticks and stones and rocks and all sorts of things in the center of a bag. Hopefully, the grader, the person who's doing the inspection of the beans in country, has caught these things, but often that they don't. And you don't want nails and rocks and sticks running through any of your machinery, because it will ruin your machinery and make the chocolate taste bad as well. Right? If you have a little twig and you put it in the roaster and the twig catches on fire, all of a sudden you have smoky flavored chocolate, which is not necessarily a good thing, unless it's done on purpose. There's a guy I know who actually does a wood oven roaster. He's a wood oven roaster down in Texas, and he actually is using that. It's a pretty fabulous kind of story. Anyway, the beans get cleaned, which means that all of the extraneous material is removed. In most cases, the outside of the beans are also sanitized with a high-temperature, high-pressure steam. This is done to kill E. coli, salmonella, traces of molds, mildews, anything that might be on the outside of the beans, which might have either been on the bean and transported across the ocean or caught up in the beans as it was transported from one part of the world to another. The next step is roasting. It's hard to underestimate the importance of the roasting step in the creation of the chocolate. This is where black art meets science, meets alchemy, meets just intuition, and where it really does take years of experience to be able to go and say, all right, I've worked with these cocoa beans. I know what they taste like. I know what I want them to taste like. And so the art of making chocolate in many cases is being able to take beans from one country, roasting them this way, taking beans from another company or another country and roasting them another way, and then mixing them together in this percentage with this amount of sugar and being able to end up with something that's absolutely lovely and absolutely tasty. I mean, it does take years and years usually in order to be able to develop that intuition, that feel, being able to look at the bean, being able to smell the bean and understand what kind of chocolate flavor that bean is going to be able to generate when roasted and gone through the rest of the process. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting is that almost every chocolate maker focuses on an ideal or optimum roast for any particular bean. And one of the things that I've noticed in my experience making chocolate is that different roasts, which are time and temperature, so how long, what temperature you subject the bean to, different roasts bring out different flavors. And so what's interesting is that many chocolate makers don't explore the fact that if I roast bean A for a long time at a low temperature and the same bean for a short time at a high temperature, I generate different flavors and maybe I can mix those flavors together. There's not a whole lot of blending that gets done within a particular bean varietal, which I think is an area of exploration that's going to be a hotbed for the next couple of years, over the next couple of years, to sort of move away from single origin, you know, this is the way I see it. You know, there are 75 chocolates made from beans from the same plantations in the San Marino Valley of Madagascar. We don't need another one done the same way that everybody else is doing. Let's experiment. And this is certainly one way experimenting where with roasting profiles that can be done. The cocoa bean is covered with a shell, and that shell needs to be removed. That process is called cracking or shelling. And then that shell needs to be separated from the usable, I suppose you'd say the meat of the nut. It's a seed, meat, whatever, the usable part of the cocoa bean. When it's cracked, it's called cocoa nib. And the nib is what is ground and turned into chocolate. So the shell is removed, and the cocoa nib goes through a multi-stage process. The first stage is I grind it, I don't grind it, but it gets ground. The nib gets ground. And the resultant product is called cocoa liquor or cocoa mass. It's not alcoholic. It's not clear why it's called cocoa liquor, but it's a very thick paste. To the cocoa liquor gets added the other ingredients. If you're making milk chocolate, you'd add milk powder, sugar, vanilla, other sorts of flavorings. You'd add it in. And at that point, it goes through a process called refining. And the refining process takes the particle size down to the point where it's just about where you can't feel any grittiness on your tongue. Right. After refining, the next step in the process is called conching. It was developed in 1879. It was discovered accidentally, as a matter of fact, by Rudolf Lindt, who was involved in an experiment, went away for a hunting weekend, came back on Monday morning, discovered that he had left the machinery running all weekend long, was afraid that he had destroyed the chocolate, but put his fingers in it, and it had been magically transformed, and had become silky and smooth. So the chocolate that we eat today is a very modern invention. Late 1870s was when the first chocolate that we would recognize as modern chocolate was developed. So conching is the name of this process after refining. It's called conch after the shape of the device that Rudolf Lindt, it looked like a conch shell. And the purpose of conching is twofold. The first thing they're doing is a mechanical process, and the second thing is a flavor development process. So mechanically, what we're doing is we're taking any large particles, we're trying to grind them down, smaller particles. If they're clumps of particles, we're breaking those clumps of particles up into individual particles, and we're talking about particles of what would be called cocoa powder if we removed all the fat. And then we actually want to cover every single one of those particles with fat, with cocoa butter. And it's that process which gives chocolate its velvety smooth mouth feel, right? It makes it melt in your mouth, and it's yummy and delicious. The other part that's happening at the same time is we're evaporating out, during conching, often there is a fair amount of acetic acid or vinegar smell, which is left in the beans from being dried. It's not entirely removed during roasting. There might be some other flavors, depending upon how the fermentation is done. There might be some lactic acid, which we would recognize as being sour milk, and other flavors, aromas that are in the mass that's being in the chocolate that's being conched. And so, by varying the temperature and varying how much air is mixed in and the temperature of that air and the speed at which the chocolate is beaten about, there are some people who are very adamant that you need to be very, very gentle with your chocolate, and that might take 3 or 4 days in order to be able to conch properly. And there are some people, the industrial chocolate makers, who says, let's just beat it within inches of his life as quickly as we possibly can, and let's get it through the machines in a couple of hours as opposed to a couple of days. In reality, one is not better than another. They produce different product. Obviously, if you take less time, it's less expensive. And so the trade-off from an artisan handcrafted product, which might take many days to produce, as opposed to an industrial-produced chocolate, is this trade-off in price and whether or not, ultimately, you're interested in sacrificing or making the trade-off between price and quality. One of the things that I haven't talked about is how does cocoa powder get made? Cocoa powder was invented as a way to reduce the amount of fat that was in the chocolate. Cocoa beans are roughly 50% fat. Cocoa powder is either between 10 and 12% or 20 and 22% fat. And by reducing the amount of fat, what we do is we can make a beverage, right? So chocolate was consumed until the 1800s, primarily as a beverage. And I wouldn't have a lot of fat floating on the top of what I was drinking. The whole idea of Dutch processing or alkalizing is a shortcut. If I'm not conching the chocolate, how do I remove the acidity from the chocolate? And so, rather than removing the acidity mechanically, I remove the acidity chemically. So, if we know from grade school science that if I take a base like bicarbonate of soda and I put it in an acid like a vinegar, I can neutralize it. And so I can change the pH. And that also is responsible for changing of color and changing of flavor. So if you see a red cocoa powder, it has been processed, alkalized, using a particular alkali at a particular concentration for a particular length of time. The black cocoa powder that's used to make Oreos is actually Dutched with it. Dutch processing was invented in Holland by Conrad van Houten. Is Dutch processed within an inch of its life. It's a very, very high pH, like 8, 9, 10. I mean, it's very, very neutral. And it's a very strong, and it's left in contact for a long time, and they turn it that dark color. It doesn't have much chocolate flavor anymore, but it is this fabulous color that we can play with. And it's part of the science and the art and of chocolate making. So we've come to the end of the half hour. This is a complex set of processes which people spend their entire lives, entire careers, trying to master. I've tried to give you today a quick overview, a highlight of all of the different steps in the process. In future episodes, we'll be covering individual ones in great detail. But until then, you've been listening to Straight from the Source on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find archive copies on heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes as a podcast. I'd like to thank Jack Inslee for producing and engineering today's show, and thanks to Aaron and the rest of the Heritage Radio Network team for their assistance. If you have any questions that you'd like to hear answered on future programs, give us a call at 718-497-2128, email the show at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or contact me through thechocolatelife.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.